The Laureate for Irish Fiction is an initiative of the Arts Council, and the first two holders of the title were Anne Enright and Sebastian Barry. A new Laureate for Irish Fiction is being announced today, and I'm very pleased to say that he's on the line now. Colm Tobin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire. Good morning.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a great honour. I'm actually delighted about it.
Why are you delighted about it? How does it sit with you?
Well, I think if you've been writing like I have, you know, for so long and you've written 10 novels, that the idea of just being recognised and being, I suppose, attached to an audience and given an honour, and also coming after Anne Enright and Sebastian Barry, I think it just makes me feel good. It makes me feel that what I've been doing has been useful and worthwhile.
Do you know what a laureate does?
I know what I'm going to do, I'm going to, I think you need a theme for this, some aim, some focus. And so mine will be the art of reading, that in other words, every writer begins with reading. Writing really is, you write a paragraph, you read it over. And we are in Ireland a sort of community of readers. And I think one thing that the pandemic, I think, taught us was just how important the book was, that nobody could ask you to social distance from a book. And so on the last Thursday of every month, as long as I'm Laureate, I will be partnering with Libraries Ireland to create a sort of community of readers, and we will read a single book each month, and I will talk about it, and we will have the author, if we can, if the author is alive and with us, to talk as well, so we can, in a way, read more seriously or read in greater depth or with greater focus. And that I can be involved in causing that. I will do public lecture every year on the 6th of November in Galway. I'll be doing that. And I will also be doing a blog about what I'm reading and the books that I'm thinking about and the general, so that I will blog. I will use that system to keep in touch.
So the theme is getting people reading, getting people engaged.
Well, I think people are reading anyway, but the point is to make that reading a richer experience, to give people a focus for it, to create a sort of community for it, and to sort of add my voice to it, to encourage people to read, but not just that. People are reading anyway, to make people feel that their reading experience has some sort of focus. None of us wants to be the only person reading a book we love. The whole idea is to hand on the book to someone else. And for example, we'll be starting with Claire Keegan's book, Small Things Like These, which I think has been a big book for people at Christmas. And it's a book people are talking about and passing on to other people.
I read it myself over Christmas, and I felt like I knew before I knew them the people she was writing about in the book, if that makes sense to you. They all felt really familiar.
Absolutely. And it's my territory. You know, it's New Ross, it's County Wexford. I was around then in 1985. It's such a great book. And so part of the purpose will be so that we can try and focus on thinking about the book and sort of sharing our views on the book and seeing why does that book work in that particular way for so many readers.
Yeah, and it's such a short book as well, but there's not a word wasted.
I think it's got a panorama in it, actually, that is both intimate in the way it functions with the way the household is described, the different way each daughter works. And then it moves into the very large and unexpected and public picture that we get in the convent.
So this will be the first book that you will ask people to read before they join. Can I call it a book club?
You could call it a book club. It's a partnership with Libraries Ireland. Yeah, it's a community of books. It's a community of readers.
So on the last Thursday of the month, we will be able to sit down and join
and
you online.
Yeah, and the Arts Council website will have all this information and make things very easy for people to join this. And it will be done through the libraries. So we're sort of partnering, you know, with a group that are already involved in this process of, I suppose, adding depth and, I suppose, more focus to people's reading.
And will you choose the book every month?
I will. It's a great pleasure. It's lovely. That's the nicest part of the job, actually.
And do you see that as being part of the role of Laureate? Just looking at Claire Keegan, I mean, to be a champion for other writers, young writers, perhaps?
Yeah, and also writers books that are not necessarily on everyone's agenda, try to resurrect a book that maybe has been forgotten or lost and see what that might mean to readers. I mean, I'm talking about figures like Kate O'Brien And we're certainly going to do The Anteroom, her book, which is one of my favourite books. It's not as though it's forgotten, but it's not being read with the same sort of intensity now as we're reading popular books. And we have other writers like, you know, first novels like Nisha Dolan's first novel, yeah. which we'll also be doing. So it's and Colin Barrett's book of stories. So we'll be doing a lot of new books just coming out and a lot of other books by other writers. But I suppose part of the job, in a way, is to sort of lend whatever way I've been thinking about fiction over the last 40 years and sort of lend those thoughts to a group of people who are also reading in the same way as I am. And I suppose I'm reading from a writer's perspective, but in a way that doesn't make a great difference sometimes. We're all engaged by a book in the same sort of way, both, I suppose, emotionally and intellectually.
So you're engaging with people who are already reading. Do you have plans to bring book clubs or talks to people who don't normally engage with literature?
Well, I think the aim would be to try and get a book. I suppose Claire Keegan's is a very good example that I think anyone in the country could pick up and read and find something, you know, really intense in the book about our lives now in Ireland, how we've come to where we are in Ireland. So, yes, obviously the job would be to try and make as many people as possible feel, it's not just feel the same enthusiasm, but reading for me and for large numbers of people has really been a bedrock, has really been a way of understanding life and of enriching life. So the idea of bringing that to other people, to people who haven't had that experience, I think will be just great.
Mm. You're still in the United States, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I was hoping to come back, but it's not a great time.
Yeah, it's hard to make those decisions, isn't it, around travel. And then what is life like on a day-to-day basis? College teaching, is it face-to-face or online? Or
oh, everything's online. And the figures in Los Angeles County, for example, there were 3,000 people a day getting infected a month ago. There are now 30,000 people a day getting infected. So it's rising here in a way which seems uncontrollable. So, I mean, you have to be very, very careful here.
And how do you find the online life?
It's awful. I mean, you know, you're talking into a screen and you're trying to see people in sort of tiny little pictures. And it will be just so great when this is over. It will be so great.
Yeah, it's exhausting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be like for me, someone who's used to reading, if you only had audiobooks.
Do you not audiobooks, like audiobooks?
No, they don't work for me. But some people love them, but I'm not used to them. They're not my thing. The only thing I had was audiobooks. It's just the same with the screen.
Oh, it's interesting you mention audiobooks, because we had a conversation here on the programme about them and we said occasionally they don't work. But if the narrator is the author, then there can be some added value there.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm just saying they're not for, you know, I suppose what you get used to really matters to you. And the notion of that I was brought up with the idea that a book, a physical book, was the thing. And I've never stopped with that, really.
And do you permit your books to become audiobooks?
It's really become a big business for publishers, because people come up to you and say now, oh, I've just been listening to your book. And you think, okay, I've just been listening to your book. If only I'd known it was going to be read out loud, I might have written it differently or something, you know.
And then I have to ask you then how you feel about reading a book on a screen.
Oh, I've never done that. But obviously it makes a huge difference if you're traveling or if you're on a train or something, that you can just press a button and the next page comes up. But I'm just holding a book now and looking at it and looking at the pages. So, yeah, I suppose I'm just Neanderthal. I'm just a dinosaur. Yeah, no. I just like a printed book.
I don't think so. I mean, my experience with a Kindle, I bought a William Trevor book. I read it and I loved it so much that I went out then and I bought the hard copy. So that completely defeats the purpose. I bought the book twice.
Oh, you're everyone's dream.
Yeah, a publisher's dream, right? I probably should go and buy the audio version as well, just to put the tin hat on it. How are you dealing? Just go back to coronavirus then, because people will know that you had cancer treatment not that long ago. So do you need to consider yourself vulnerable now? Do you have to cocoon, to use that word that so many people, their skin crawls when they hear it?
Yeah, I mean, it became a thing. I would say that you know, I'm in that group, so I have to be very careful. But I was, I think, a bit, you know, I wasn't still in treatment, which I think is the main thing, that I was after treatment, so I didn't feel as vulnerable. I still had to be very, very careful, and I was very careful, but I still am. But yeah, I was in that group where you really were being warned.
Mm-hmm. And people felt very upset about that they were being told, well, now your job is to stay at home and practically not leave the house.
Because I went through the cancer experience, I learned to trust doctors and believe what they were saying, just because everything they were saying turned out to be true. So therefore, when scientists and doctors said what I should do, I paid attention. I thought what they were saying was true, and I'm glad I did.
Mm-hmm. Just I want to talk to you about Joe Biden's presidency, because dealing with Omicron has been one of the main focuses. It's had to be over the last year. But his popularity ratings are around 42%. What's your assessment of his first year in power?
I think he's been unlucky that his two senators didn't help him ending the filibuster. And I think he's been, you know, that the things he needed to do, he's failed in a number of areas, and he looks very weak at the moment. It's very hard, you know, to follow Trump, because Trump dominated the news every day. Mm-hmm. People watched television in the evening to see what Trump had been up to. Biden has not said anything memorable since he was elected president, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's what we wanted. But that silence he's created, he doesn't come on shouting every night. He isn't denouncing these two senators who went against him in the heaviest and most insulting terms. And because he's not doing that, he looks weak. Whereas, you know, there are other people who might view it as a sort of that his mildness was exactly what America needed. But commentators are certainly, even in the liberal press and somewhere like the New York Times, are absolutely not on his side at the moment. He didn't get the infrastructure bill through because of one senator. But that's how democracy works. I mean, you actually have to get the numbers. And so he's in trouble in the midterms. And he's going through a bad time. He could be lucky, you know. He needs to be lucky. But at the same time, that he has reintroduced a sort of civility into the tone of public life in America, which America very badly needed. It's just that civility is being seen as a sort of weakness, as a sort of timidity on his part. But I think there is another way of looking at it, which is that it was maybe precisely what the country needed.
Yeah, I'm listening to you, and that is one side of it. And I'm listening to this BBC podcast as well about the lead up to the storming of the Capitol last year. And it explains the growth of the QAnon groups and how those groups now are becoming much more mainstream. And you have them going to Republican Party conventions. And then we hear Donald Trump is building up this war chest of election funds, which I think has reached 115 million. And that he certainly hasn't gone away. I mean, how do you view the growth of that whole phenomenon on the other side?
I think that Americans, I'm talking about most Americans, have a reverence for their own institutions, which is really astonishing sometimes. They learn about their own constitution in high school, and it really means something to them. The flag, the national anthem, the presidency, the White House, the institutions. And I still view the storming of the Capitol as something that at election time, that enough people, especially older people who may be conservative in some ways, will look at and say, that is not what we want to happen to our country again. And the more the Capitol event gets, the more Trump gets implicated in that. And the Supreme Court judgment yesterday is very significant, because it opens up all the papers in the National Archives showing what he was doing throughout that day for each second of the day. And the more he can be connected to that actual event, and his sons can be connected to it, the more it will make people hesitate in that moment before they vote, where they'll think, even though I support his policies in some ways, that storming the Capitol is one step too far. So that's, I mean, that I'm being optimistic about that. I'm actually still believing that despite the growth in these marginal groups and the fact that the periphery is moving towards the center, mm-hmm, in the right in America, that there will be enough people on the right in America, conservative people, who are conservative enough to view at the storming of the Capitol as being a step too far.
And we can't take our eyes off the situation in Downing Street at the moment and in Westminster with Boris Johnson under severe pressure over those parties. Do you think he can survive this?
Hoist on his own petard. In other words, the Arch-Chancellor takes one chance too many. And it's another great example, I think, of the idea that you can push people in a democracy as old as the British one up to a certain point. And then there comes a tipping point when you can't do that anymore. So that my view of both American democracy and of British democracy is that these democracies have roots, and that these roots are taken seriously by many people, including conservative people. And that in the case of the storm in the Capitol, and the case of Boris's antics around having all these parties and sending a wheelie suitcase to get drink down the road, which is something you think, surely that was in Ireland. Surely that must have happened somewhere, you know, in a county council meeting, you know, in some place in Ireland. No, this happened in Downing Street. And it certainly must make a lot of people feel sick.
Now, just back briefly to your own work. You've got a new collection of poetry called Vinegar Hill. That's coming this year, is it?
Yes. I mean, it was one of the things the pandemic could allow. Long days of silence, long days with no social activity or no going out to films or, you know. And I haven't had a drink since I had cancer. So no alcohol, no social life. And about 7 o'clock every evening, some memory would occur, some funny little thing, and I would write a line down. And by the end of the evening, I would have the first draft of a poem and I would work all the next day. So it's one of the things that the pandemic did. I'm not sure Ireland does need another poet. It has a lot of very good ones. And joining at my age is a bit late. But nonetheless, I do have this book coming out in April.
I've made a note, no alcohol, no social life leads to poetry.
That's correct. At least that's why the Irish monks were so good at copying manuscripts and being sort of busy generally with bits of paper and making books, that all that monastic life leads to literature.
Colm, we'd love to catch up with you again when you're settled into the role as laureate. But for now, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's the new laureate for Irish fiction, Colm Tobin.